Welcome to Books and Beyond with Bound. I'm Tara Khandelwal.
And I'm Michelle DeCosta.
In this podcast, we talk to India's finest authors
and uncover the stories behind the best written book
and dissect how these books shape our lives and worldviews today.
So let's dive in.
This episode is part of our branded series with Penguin Random House India.
Hi everyone, welcome back. I'm Michelle, your host, and most of you might know by now that I've been raised Catholic. So, you know, I might know a thing or two about the Bible. I read the children's illustrated version as a child, and growing up, obviously, you know, I've read the updated version for adults. But what I wasn't really familiar with was the Hindu epics, that is the Mahabharata and the Ramayana, and which is why, you know, I'm really excited to do this episode today. I'm very excited, as we'll be immersed in the worlds of both of these epics with none other than Amit Majumdar and Shantanu Gupta. While Amit Majumdar's book, Book of Vows, it's actually first in a trilogy, and it's a retelling of the Mahabharata, you know, in its own way. I mean, the crux of the Mahabharata is it's literally about a war between the Pandavas and the Kauravas, right? But what he does really well in this book is that he actually focuses on these vows, right? As he puts it, you could break a vow, but you couldn't unsay it, right? Because it focuses on this time, this particular time in the universe where, you know, the gods, your descendants, everyone would compare what you said to what you did. Imagine a world like that, right? And what I found interesting is that he's provided sequences or summaries at the beginning of each of these chapters, which for a person like me was really super useful because I do not have much context about it, right? And on the other hand, we have Shantanu Gupta, who's written the book Teachings from the Ramayana, right? And now we all know that the Ramayana is actually an epic of 24,000 shlokas or verses, right? Which actually tells the story of Ram. But in his book, what Shantanu does really well is that he has picked 25 stories or case studies with just focus on family life. And that's why I was really interested because, you know, all of you listeners know that I'm really drawn to family dramas, especially because of the power dynamics, you know, that plays around with different family members. So what he's done is he's actually made the book very interactive. He's added crossword puzzles, reflective exercises so that people can actually have conversations that matter, you know, while having breakfast, lunch, or dinner, right? Like, how many of us still have conversations while having meals? So let's dive into these epics and find out from these both authors how they have managed to take these ancient texts and make them very contemporary. So welcome, Amit and Shantanu.
Hi, thank you for having us.
Thank you, Michelle. Thank you for having us.
So, you know, to start off, Amit and Shantanu, both of you, you all have very different educational backgrounds, right? Amit, you've done nuclear medicine. You're a diagnostic radiologist and you actually practice in Ohio, right? Which is where you're based out of. Shantanu, on the other hand, you have degrees in management, engineering, governance. You're also a political analyst, right? And as if all of this wasn't interesting enough, both of you are very clearly passionate about mythology, right? And Amit, you've also written a verse translation of the Bhagavad Gita called the God Song. Before Shantanu, you know, you're the founder of the Ramayana School, which actually dives into these stories and where you, you know, sort of dissect these stories and sort of impart these lessons to different people, be it families, educators, entrepreneurs. So now for both of you, I want to know, where did this passion for, you know, recording or analyzing or retelling these epics actually start?
I think first, you use the word mythology. I want to present my reservation to that word because in Indian knowledge system, Mahabharata and Ramayana, both are part of Itihasa. And not only Ramayana, it's Valmiki Ramayana and Vedavyasa Mahabharata, not other versions of Mahabharata or other versions of Ramayana, right? So all the stories on Indian knowledge system are largely packed in Itihasas or Puranas. Mythology is a Western term, which is like kind of, it's a myth, right? It's not historical. You can't put a date to it. These characters might be fictional. So that's why I normally stay away from that word. And I call it only in Amazon, they put your book into mythology category and I don't have a heft enough to change the category. So there only I use the word. So that's one. How I started my journey is I'm homeschooling my kids. I have a 5-year-old and a 10-year-old. So my 10-year-old, when he was around 6-ish, he came to me with a question that after Rama, Sri Rama breaks the dhanush, right? During the Sita Swayamvar, Parashuram shows up, right? When Lord Parashuram shows up, he's also one of the avatars of Vishnu. He's the sixth avatar of Vishnu, and Sri Ram is the seventh avatar of Vishnu. So the question of my son was that how come both the avatars can exist together? But his idea was linear, that one avatar will go back and another avatar will come, right? Let's say in Mahabharata, Krishna has come, who's the eighth avatar, right? I also did not have a very clear answer, so I gave him some answer just to satisfy his curiosity. And during the same time, almost the same time, I was writing the biography of Yogi Adityanath, because I'm a political writer, that's what I do, right? So I was traveling from Lucknow to Gorakhpur very often. Gorakhpur is the place where Yogi Adityanath does his work. That time, now he's in Lucknow. So in between comes Ayodhya, and my driver, and being a very practicing Hindu, this is the first time I was seeing Ayodhya around 6 years back, though fortunately I was a part of the Pran Pratishtha event. So I went to Ayodhya, talked to a lot of scholars, and then I started engaging in Ramayana like a little profoundly with the traditional scholars and modern scholars. Started reading the verses, shlokas, as we call it, in Valmiki Ramayana, the original source from Gita Press Gorakhpur, and various other commentaries. And then I realized that Ramayana, it's a huge text, and Mahabharata is an even bigger text. It's like almost four times of Ramayana. It's like a modern chat GPT, right? You send a query to Ramayana and Ramayana will give you an answer. And my query was that how can I contextualize Ramayana for my son? That was a very simple, basic, selfish query, right? I see him engaged in a lot of his kind of books. Like, how can I make it interesting for him? And also while I'm reading him, what can I take it? Like from my life, for my profession, what can I take it from Ramayana? And from there, around 6 years back, the journey started. And then I send the query, life lessons. Right. If you send a different query, if you send what are the governance lessons, you can get it. If you say what are the entrepreneurship lessons, you can get it. And there'll be my sequels for my books. Right. So that's how my journey started. So that, as you rightly said, can I make my book as an appetizer for people to read the original version? I always say people should read the original text, which is quite a work. 24,000 shlokas. If you read 10 shlokas a day, that'll take 7-8 years, right? And 10 shlokas will take you at least 1 hour. The 1 hour a day is quite a discipline in itself. So yeah, that's how my journey started, to simplify it, to bring it to breakfast table, to bring it to dinner table. Yeah, and how can my son understand it? So yeah, now it came as a book.
Wow, that's an excellent story, an excellent way of approaching it. And, you know, relative to what you were mentioning about the word mythology in English, the interesting thing about myth and mythos, mythology in English, is that it has, you know, two ways in which it's used. One of the ways is to say, oh, you know, that's a myth. It's falsehood, basically. It's made up. It's fictional, or it's airy fairy. People were coming up with it out of nothing. But there's another way in which the word mythology is used. And if you look at the way Joseph Campbell talks about mythology, if you look at some of the most serious students of that way of knowledge, that form of knowledge, that way of thinking, that way of encoding knowledge, and encoding truth in a way that binds an entire civilization for hundreds of years, thousands of years. It's actually that way, when you use it that way, it's a term of respect and a term of mystery and profound power. And one of the very interesting things that I found is that mythology, mythological epics of this nature, it remains, but it can spawn all sorts of books. So Shantanu's books, where he's talking about, you know, I give it a query and I can, and he eventually you can write a whole book about it, a whole book of expository prose on governance, as he said, you know, this, that, the other, different topics. One poetic epic, one poem written 3,000 years ago, can to this day spawn entire nonfiction books that end up getting sold in bookstores around the country. That's an amazing and mysterious process. And for me personally, and I hate to get mystical or weird about it, I kind of feel like I have a past life connection to this stuff. And I always have. I always felt a strange familiarity with it. I felt a strange sense of, this is where I belong, this is where I come from, and this is where I belong. And the Book of Vows, for example, the whole trilogy came very, very easily, very, very quickly. It was COVID time. And interestingly enough, when it comes to mythology and the Gita and everything, I've been doing that for years, ever since I was a teenager. I've been into it. But I had always thought to myself, am I ever going to tackle the Mahabharata? When am I going to do that? And it took COVID to scare me and basically say, I thought to myself, I was always putting it off, but then I thought, people are dying and who knows, I could get hit, right? And I have limited time on earth and I need to do this now. And so the whole trilogy was written, first page to last page in a I guess in a frenzy of sorts, during COVID. And it's a lot of pages, but it took a lot less time than you would imagine because I was driven. It's like I had a gun to my head. I had a microbiological gun to my head. And I just felt like I was fulfilling some fundamental aspect of why I was born when I engaged in this epic and retold it for modern audiences in a way that was very faithful to the original. Because one of the other things I've noticed is that and myths are always an evolution, and people always change little things about the myth. Sometimes, though, in more modern times, they drastically alter the mythology and drastically alter the story to make revered figures venal and to make traditionally criticized figures heroic. That's something that's typically done. I didn't want to do that. I wanted to get back to the source, and I wanted to create a work that people could read in which the same old story, quote unquote, would be alive and vivid. And that's what I hope to have done with the Book of Vows and the two remaining volumes of the trilogy.
Wow, yeah, I think just listening to both of your, processes, just sort of how did this start? I think, one common thing that I've seen is that it's a calling, right? Both of you seem to be just naturally drawn to this theme or to these epics. And it's sort of like you said, I mean, it doesn't feel like it's a lot of words. It doesn't feel like you've done a lot because I think this is something that, it's sort of like you had to tell this story. That's something that's really common with both of you. And so this really brings me to my next question, which is that, see, we have seen so many retellings in recent times, right? So for example, with, Chitra Devakurni, she's retold the Mahabharata through the eyes of the women, right? For example, then we've also spoken to Ashok Banker, who's explored love stories from the Mahabharata, because obviously Mahabharata is known for war and fights and all of that. And then, you take a different angle to that. And also we recently spoke to Shatrujit Nath, who's told the story of Bharat, who's Ram's brother, where these underrated or sort of hidden characters, in these epics are given life, which also sort of goes into fantasy a bit, right? So now you have this whole genre in India, which is sort of, I would say, booming, and there's also sort of this scare or fear of saturation, right? Because that's what happens in a genre when you have so much coming out of it, which is why I want to know, did you all sort of worry that this book will sort of get lost among the number of books that are coming out right now? Or what, according to you, is the USP of your book? And that's something that need not, would have been sort of apparent while you were writing it or while you sort of set out to write. But even let's say, now that the book has written and it's gone out into the world, is that something you'll think about?
I think you're right. There, even for Ramayana, Mahabharata, and many other, I'll still want to use the word Itihasa and Purana. There are multiple retellings, right? And there were reasons for retelling. So let's say for Valmiki Ramayana, Rishi Valmiki was contemporary of Lord Ram, right? He can like I'm a biographer of Yogi Adityanath. He's a biographer of Rama. He can talk to Ram. He has a direct source, Mata Sita. Mata Sita was living in Valmiki's ashram. So he's a direct source. He can talk to a lot of sages, a lot of co-kings, a lot of people around, right? So it's a first-hand account, so to say, right? And he was writing about a king, a good king, who was back from those 14 years of vanvas, of exile, right? He's back already. He's talking to Narad Muni, and he's talking to Narad Muni and telling that I want to write something which many generations can remember and can live a very meaningful life of dharma, artha, kama, moksha. Can he have some role model? He said, why don't you look upon that King Rama? And so Valmiki ji was in Kanpur of today, which is Bithur, which is like in today's modern travel, 4 or 5 hours travel from Ayodhya, right? So it's like a nearby king versus, let's say, the other very famous Ramayana is Tulsidas Ramacharitmanas, right? Which is written almost just 500 years back when Akbar, the Mughal king, was ruling India. And Rama was already established as a god in Indian society. So Tulsidas was writing about a god Rama versus Valmiki was writing about a very good king, a Maryada Purushottam, which is a huge difference of your vantage point, right? Whom are you writing about? Let's say I've written about Yogi Adityanath, which is like a political biography. After 500 years, who knows? People say, okay, Yogi Adityanath was a god, right? And if someone someone do that retelling will be very, very different, right? And also the language. The language also carries a lot of weight, right? So Valmiki Ramayana is written in Sanskrit. That was the order of language of the day. And that's very high Sanskrit, right? That's very high Sanskrit in Anustup Chanda. Versus Tulsi Ramayana, which is written in Avadhi. Why Avadhi? Because Sanskrit was lost by then. A lot of Brahmins, a lot of priests were killed by the Islamic invaders. So, and the Sanskrit retelling would not have worked. So Avadhi, which is a local dialect, I should not call it a dialect. A lot of people may not like to hear it. It's a language which is very close to Hindi, but spoken in eastern part of Uttar Pradesh now. So Tulsi Das was existing in today's Chitrakoot, today's Banaras, today's Ayodhya, right? So he took the language of that area and then retold in Avadhi, right? So I think this is how the context changed. And he has done, that's why Ramcharitmanas is quite a glorification of Rama versus Valmiki Ramayana is a very practical, if I can use the word, a little boring and filled with a lot of details, right? Which are details, is like, why I need so many details, right? About Rama's father and his father and his father and his father and almost 64 people before Rama till Ishvaku, right? I don't need so much detail. Let's say if I am talking about Harry Potter, I know his father, I know maybe his grandfather, but I don't know his 10th and 20th grandfather, right? So, because it's a documentation. Valmiki is documenting Rama's life like a meticulous historian versus a Tulsi who is writing to recontextualize Rama in the society where the legend of Rama is kind of dying, right? So that's why I think every generation needs the retelling of a story in their context, in their pains, in their happinesses, right? Because happiness of today and the pains of today and the challenges of today are very different every 100 years or even every generation. So that's why I think retelling will never stop. And then comes the point of view, right? As you said, a point of view of Rama, there are Ramayana written with a point of view of Ravana. There, as you said, with Bharata's point of view, you can write from the Kekai's point of view. A lot of people give the credit of whole Ramayana to Kekai. If Kekai would not have given that Vanvas or exile, then whole thing would not have happened, right? So you can take a point of view. But again, you have to go back that is Valmiki ji giving some hint or not, right? So many point of view. And even in Valmiki Ramayana itself, as I told you in the starting, you can make many, many queries. You will be surprised to know a lot of people have done a research on fauna and flora, which Rama encountered during the 14 years. Because he's passing through today's Uttar Pradesh, today's Chhattisgarh, today's Madhya Pradesh, today's Jharkhand, today's Maharashtra. In fact, Mata Sita was kidnapped in Maharashtra in near Nasik. Then today's Karnataka, today's Tamil Nadu. And he, Lakshman, whenever Sita was around, they're talking about whatever vegetation they're seeing, what kind of animal are seeing. And a lot of PhD scholars have done PhD that is the vegetation of that time matching today, right? And it's matching in most of the cases, right? In those areas, right? So you can do multiple kind of queries to Ramayana and multiple kind of point of views, right? So that's why I'm saying retelling has a scope if you can find your niche, but you should know what all is already being written so that you can know what is already not written. Yeah.
And just to add to that, which is why I think, you know, like if we talk of the USP of your book, which is why you focus just on family life, right? Just on
that's on family life right now. And my sequels, maybe I'll say what an entrepreneur can see into it, what a politician can see into it, what a child can see into it. So I will go like this construct-wise. Family is a construct. Being entrepreneur is a construct, right? So with different roles, because we all play different roles. I'm a father, I'm a husband, I'm a brother, I'm a son, I'm an entrepreneur, I'm a colleague. So with different roles, can I use Ramayana as my decision-making framework, right? Can I learn from Rama and Dashrath and Vanaraj and Ravana? Maybe we can learn from Ravana also, what not to do, right? So yeah, that way is my take.
Oh yeah, and so it delights me that you mentioned Tulsidas, because I'm actually translating the Sundarkand into rhymed verse right now, and that's one of my projects that I'm ongoing. And I agree with you about your contrast between Tulsidas and Valmiki. When it's very interesting also, because at that point Sita Mata is also divine, and so in Tulsidas, Sita, it's not Sita who's actually abducted. He puts, Sita is placed for safekeeping inside Agni. And then it's a Maya Sita, or like Mayavi Sita, or illusory Sita, who is abducted and taken to Lanka. And so it's not really, because she's inviolable. But what's interesting is that 400 years before that, when Kampan writes his Tamil version of the Ramayana, there already Sita is still uninviolable. She mustn't be touched. And so Ravan in that version has a curse on him where he can't touch a woman against her will. So he has to dig up the earth beneath her. And he takes the earth, he takes the ground that she's on, and she's almost like trapped on this island of earth because he's so strong. He lifts up that island and he takes that island to Lanka, that chunk of earth that she's standing on. And those are different ways in which poets have navigated the sanctity of, the growing sanctity of Rama and Sita over the centuries, which Valmiki didn't have that problem, as Shantanu mentioned, because Valmiki was writing so long ago. And in fact, in the Yudhakhand, there's probably one of my favorite scenes in the Ramayana, in Valmiki's Ramayana, where it's at the end, and Rama has sort of berated, Sita after he has liberated her. Now he berates her, and Brahma and the gods, first of all, everyone around him is horrified. All right, so it's not as though society was misogynistic then or anything like that. Rama's acting completely out of character. He's got some sort of, PTSD sort of thing going on. He's out of character. He's out of his, normal self, because all through the rest of the epic, he's been weeping with just, anguish that he doesn't have Sita with him. At that moment, Brahma comes, and Brahma berates him as well. And he says, "Well, don't you know who you are?" And Rama says, "I believe I'm Prince Rama, son of King Dasharatha. You tell me who I am." And that's when Brahma tells him that he is the avatar of Vishnu and that he is this great figure, the divine figure, and an incarnation of Vishnu. So Rama has lived the entirety of the Ramayana with the a belief that he was a human being, and he has experienced that anguish just as a human being would. He's experienced the pain of separation from his wife just as a human being would. And Michelle, you'll recognize this from the story of Jesus, right? Because Jesus was in, the son of man, right? He was a son of man. He experienced the suffering on the cross as a human being. That pain was real, right? In the same way, Rama's pain in Valmiki Ramayana is real because he doesn't know who he is. He has no idea. And it's not until the end, until he has sort of transgressed against Sita, that he is then berated. He's told who he is in the form of, being berated about it by the gods, by Brahma, by his creator. And so, as far as retellings are concerned, Shantanu's absolutely right. And language is one of the main things. And that's the language to me is central, because linguistic drift happens. It happens to in all societies. And if you look at how the Sundarkand or the Ramcharitmanas sounds, it's very, very tightly rhymed. It's tightly rhymed. You can sing it. The language is actually very simple, and there isn't that much detail because he's keeping that story humming. All right, he's keeping that story going along. And he'll dilate, meaning he'll kind of stretch out the story for a bit and give you more verses when he wants to just sing some praises of Rama, or he sings some praises of Sita. And then he'll go back. But if you look closely, and because I read Valmiki Ramayana and started translating Tulsidas so close to one another, there are times where, so Valmiki will devote an entire sarga to describing Ravana sleeping there among his wives with his tattoos and his scars and his beautiful body, because Ravana was very handsome and he was a very impressive guy. Tulsidas will go through it in a line. He'll have a line. Then Ravana was sleeping there, and then this happened, then this happened, and the charm is in the rhyme, and the charm is in the speed, and then in the lilt and the jauntiness of it, and in Valmiki, the charm is in the intricacy, and the charm is in the dialogues, the charm is in the monologues of people expressing their anguish and everything like that. And so there's so many different ways, even among the great retellings which tell the whole epic, there are drastic differences in the approach, right?
So
And
in
those are
your
all things that different retellers navigate. And it's a beautiful tradition, and you can find something different in every last one, every last retelling.
Correct. No, so in your case, Amit, I'm very curious of how you picked the USP or the angle of wows, especially. How did that come?
So very almost without intending to, the retelling, my retelling, naturally fell into three sections. Okay. And in that first section, that first volume, as I was retelling it, I became very, very aware of how many vows were being taken and what massive effects these had, all right, on the story. And as I kind of naturally, I told you I wrote it very, very, very in a state of kind of in intense concentration and intense excitement. When I finished the first volume, I realized that it basically began with Bhishma's vow, right? Which Bhishma's vow was that I'm going to exclude myself from the inheritance of the throne, and I'm going to allow my father's remarriage with this fisherwoman's daughter to then establish the lineage for the throne of Hastinapur, and I will devote myself to to protecting that lineage. He takes this vow, and it gives him his name because originally he's Devarut, and then he becomes Bhishma, fearsome, in honor of his vow. And then I kept the entire story going, and the first volume, Book of Vows, ends immediately after the dice game, when the Pandavas take these vows as they're leaving on their exile. They say things like, "I'm coming back, and I'm coming back for you, you know, and I'm going to get you in this particular way at some point in the future." And later on, that's exactly what happens. Their vows, they say it, and then they do it. All right, and it's very gangster. It's very mafia. You know, I love it. It's like you did this to my wife, and now I'm going to do this to you. And they take these vows, and those vows then determine the subsequent story of the epic. And so the final book, the third book, is called the Book of Killings. And that's exactly what they do, because they tell them they're going to kill him, and then that's the Book of Vows that they take in book one. In book three, they do
They
the
do
killing
it.
how to do.
It's exactly like the mafia, you know, like you said, reminds me of The Godfather. But you know, but jokes apart, I think, you know, it's very interesting to see. I think, you know, what's common between both of you is that yes, the epic is there, it's been rewritten, it's been, you know, retold, there are so many versions, but yet again, there is a way to have a unique POV, right? In your case, Shantanu, is the fact that, you know, as you said, it's a construct, and every time you can look at it in a different way, you will find something there, right? So be it family life, be it entrepreneurship. And in your case, Amit, I think the wows is something that really stood out to you, right? So now I really want to know, you know, what are you both sort of, you know, I would say, like, you know, as people, right? So now we know that you all love the epics, right? It's something that you all have grown up with, you know, you all as academics, as writers, it's something that has kept you going. But I want to know more about you as people, right? So for example, Amit, right, promises or vows, you know, clearly takes the forefront, you know, in the first book. So I was wondering, you know, do promises actually mean something to you in your life, you know, in a world where they say promises are meant to be broken? You know, could you please probably share an anecdote from your life where this has played an, you know, important role in forming how you think about vows? And Shantanu, for you know, because your book highlights, you know, family life, parenting, all of that. And this is something you've mentioned before, that you know, sort of your conversations with your son when you were homeschooling, it's something that sort of stood out to you. But I want to know, you know, especially when you sort of deal with families, like in your conversations with families, did you sort of see that there's a gap in bonding between families? You know, maybe could you please share an anecdote?
See, I want to quote two quick instances from the Ramayana first, and then I'll see how it's reminding me constantly. And so first one is when Rama was about to be coronated as a king tomorrow, the next day, and then the plotting happens between Kekayi and Mantha, right? That Rama should be sent to exile for 14 years, and Bharata, his direct son, sorry, her direct son, Kekayi's direct son, should be made as the king, right? Now, those were the two choices, whether to agree to Kekayi's demands or not agree to Kekayi's demand. Because the promise that he has given to Kekayi is like a verbal promise, right? And there was no big testimony to it, right? Maybe the charioteer might have heard, right? But they both were in a war. So that time, he gave that vow, right, to Kekayi. Now, the hindsight is, if he agreed to the demands, the two demands, he will lose his son for 14 years and maybe forever, because in maybe he may die or Rama may die, because jungle is like an unknown territory, from demons to animals. There's everything there, right? And also, Ayodhya will lose such an amazing king. Ayodhya has a tradition of Suryavanshi, amazing Suryavanshi kings, solar dynasty kings. So he has two hindsight. But the very famous Tulsi Ramayana Chopa is Raghukul Reet Sadachaliyai Pran Jaye Par Vachan Na Jaye, meaning this is a tradition in my family. I'm the descendant of Ishvaku to Harishchand to Ajay to Raghu. I will die, but I will not go bad on a promise, right? And later, while talking to Kaushalya, he refers also that if I will not work on a promise, who will? My subject will say, "Oh my God, my king is going bad on promise. Who am I?" Right? So in the morning I'll do a promise, and by the evening I'll break. So there'll be harakiri in the society. And in fact, that's the current Kaliyug society is. If you go to any courts of law, most of the cases are breach of agreements, check bounces, which is nothing but a breach of agreement. We and these are signed agreements, mind you. Dashrath had a verbal commitment with KK that whenever you want, like a magnanimous king, you can ask for two vows, right? And we are going back on the written agreements now and going to the court of law, the modern construct, right? Similarly, so now Rama goes out. Rama goes out. So how the legend of promise was so important for someone like Dashrath. Now cut the story short. Rama is in jungle now. Bharat comes back. He sees the whole Ayodhya is so dilapidated, right? Everybody's crying. No Rama there, no Lakshman there, no Sita there. And he goes in the hunt of them. He finds them in Chitrakoot, right? And there, the conversation between Bharat and Rama is a beautiful conversation, right? I doubt we will ever see the conversation in Kaliyug. Bharat is saying to Rama, "Why don't you come back and become the king?" And Rama is saying, "No, no, no, you go back and be the king," right? Today's brother will say, "No, no, you get out. I'll be the CEO of the company," right? "I don't need you." So here, two brothers are convincing each other, you should be the king. And Rama is saying, now because Dashrath is dead, I cannot go bad on the promise even more, because now I cannot ask for an apology to Dashrath. Earlier I could have, okay, I'm not able to do the Vanvas. Can I take a shortcut to Vanvas instead of 14 years? Can I make it 2 years? But I don't have anyone. So because he's dead, I'm all the more bound to the promise. And whenever I read all of this, I get into a little guilt, right? Like, I'm writing all of this, I'm reading all of this, but am I following in my personal life? And when I also run a Ramayana school. I teach Ramayana to a lot of kids, almost like a couple of thousand kids in multiple countries. And whenever I tell the story of Ramayana, not only these two ideas, multiple other ideas of morality, it challenges my own morality in life. Like, am I following? I'm preaching so much, but am I following? Keep reminding me. And in the last 4 or 5 years, my engagement in Ramayana certainly, I feel, made me a better person, right? It keeps on reminding me. It keeps on reminding me. So yeah, I think when you write, it nudges you personally, multiple times, multiple times. Yeah. So that's my engagement with Ramayana from last couple of years.
So yeah, and that's beautiful, beautifully spoken. I think that if you look on the first couple pages of the Book of Vows, you'll see me make a vow, right? And at the beginning of the Book of Vows, I say, "I, Amit Himachu Majmudar, I take a vow to do this, to tell this story." And so you have to be as good as your word, right? You have to be as good as your word, and that point, to be as good as your word. It has ramifications throughout your life, meaning that people can trust you, right? Because people then around someone get a sense of, can that guy, if that guy says something, can I trust that it's going to happen? That'll happen in a professional setting. It'll also happen in an interpersonal setting, right? And so I've always tried to be a man of my word, I think, in general. And definitely when it came to the Book of Vows, putting that line at the very beginning on the very first page, it was a signal not just to the reader. It was really my inner self. It was my inner self ordering my outer self to do the work and put in the work. And that inner controller bound me to it. And so one way or another, I was going to accomplish that, and I'm proud that I did. But I'm above all proud that I kept the vow that I made to myself.
Yeah, that's great. I really liked the instances that you mentioned also, Shantanu, especially the conversation between Bharat and Ram, which is like, oh, it wouldn't be logical in today's world, right? It reminded me sort of like, in the Bible they say, if someone slaps you, you turn the other cheek, and we say, oh, but in today's world, who will do that? Right. So I think it's very interesting to see that though these lessons in morality, ethics, all of that has been there throughout the years, I think what we also do is we sort of apply or tweak it based on, contemporary life, which is what both of you said, right? So, Amit, you've kept the vow that you've given. So You know what I found really interesting, honestly, about both of your books is the presentation of the information, right? So, of course, the content is something we know. We have read time and again. These epics have been, told, been taught in schools. They have been sort of, discussed time and again. But it's about how you present them, right? So, Amit, in your case, the fact that you've sort of consciously decided to put sequences or summaries in the beginning, how did that come about? Is it probably because, you're based out of the US and sort of, I mean, sort of like, did you envision a white reader or someone who's not as familiar with the epics, to sort of read that? And in Shantanu's case, why did you sort of add these reflective exercises, where there are blanks throughout in the book and where you've sort of made it, like a very personal sort of guidebook for the reader? How did that come up? Yeah.
So the structure of my book, as you said in the starting, Valmiki Ramayana is 24,000 verses, right? Shlokas. I've condensed that chronologically, though, from Balakand to Yudhakand into 25 case studies, right? And every chapter will start first the story of Ramayana, right? So I'll start with Balakand, where Rama is getting born, right? And then I will try to pick up a conversation between two or multiple characters, which is conveying me something, right? Which I can relate to any possible life situation in today's modern life, in today's Kali Yuga, right? So that's the first telling of Ramayana story, right? And based on Valmiki Ramayana. And then I will write a lesson which I will derive. So let's say I will read any random, I'm holding the book. Let's say rules are meant to be followed and flouting them can endanger your life. This is from Mata Sita, where she's flouting the Lakshman Rekha rule, right? And then, so this I'll write a like a life lesson. Then I'll write a very practical family scenario, which I might have faced in my life, or one of my colleagues, one of my friends, which is a very relatable family scenario with some real names, right? Of a family, of a Amit and his wife. And then I'll pose a question: what will you do in such a family case if they will arrive? And then I will give the answer from Rama's point of view or Dashrath's point of view, that if Dashrath or Rama would have been there, how they would have solved or handled this situation. So these 25 case studies, I'm trying to give them a decision framework that, okay, in such multiple situations, right, how can you use or apply Ramayana? And then I'm giving these reflective sections with, as you say, the empty lines, that, okay, why don't you bring this conversation on a breakfast table or a dinner table and try to say, what if this would have happened? What if this would have happened? So that Ramayana will become a case study. And fortunately, blasphemy is not a problem in Hindu tradition. You can still challenge your gods, right? That's the whole topic of Shastrarth, where you can question the existing thing and you can say, what are the multiple layers that could have happened? So I think these reflective exercises are to instigate conversation in the family, right? What can you derive from different conversations? That's the whole format of my book. And then after the end of each kand, Balakand to Yudhakand, which is six kands, I have given a crossword puzzle so that you can remember the names, the places, the incidents, right? So I've made a cross six crossword puzzle throughout my book. So that's the format. And also, while doing Ramayana school artwork, I got a lot of artwork done through a professional artist. So I had a copyright of that. I produced the black and white version of all those artwork in the relevant section. So just to make it more, even more real, right? So yeah, this is how
So,
my book is.
yeah, I mean, it's really interesting because see the structure, like you said, right? There's a very clear agenda. You want it to be sort of a decision framework. But how did you sort of arrive at this combination? What was that process like?
I think this not happened with the book time. As I told you, I run Ramayana School, right? So I started doing this session from last couple of years back, and there it was like a Ramayana story and then a lesson, right? But these case studies I invented myself during writing this book, because during the course I gave one or two case studies here and there, but not for every case, right? So this I invented along sitting with my family, calling my sister who is a teacher in a school and deals with a lot of children. Like I'm homeschooling my kids, so my wife is more involved. She's part of a lot of homeschooling groups, talking to her, right? And seeing a lot of my situations, talking to friends, what can fit, what can be a beautiful case which can fit in this scenario, in the Surpanakha scenario, in the Ram Ravan scenario, right? So talking to a lot of my friends, peers who are readers normally, who are living normal lives, that what can connect to them, right? So that was a tougher part, in fact. So Ramayana, because I have a decent understanding of Ramayana by now, that retelling was easier, but contextualizing it to the Kali Yuga was a difficult part too. So yeah, I've done it by crowdsourcing the information with a lot of my friends and family.
It's very interesting to see the collaborative effort behind it. Yeah. Yeah, Amit, what about you?
Yeah. So you mentioned that, did I have an American reader in mind, or someone who wasn't familiar with the epic? And I absolutely did. And I wrote it Not just for them, though. And I feel that when there's a lengthy book, it's good to have certain, signposts along the way. And what was also interesting is that as I was kind of mentally bundling this set of chapters and then this set of chapters and then this set of chapters and getting a sense of, okay, how can I summarize it for someone who's unfamiliar with the epic? I began to realize that the Mahabharata, which I kind of mentally imagined as being very, very spread out and not particularly tight as a narrative, actually has a very, very powerful internal structure, has a strong kind of bone structure as a story. It's an extended story. Now, something like the Iliad or the Odyssey, it kind of focuses on a few characters. The Iliad is a specific, the wrath of Achilles. Achilles sits out the war and then he comes back into the war. The Odyssey is the homecoming of Odysseus. It's not the entire epic cycle of the entire story of the Trojan War. The Mahabharata is. It's the entire story from the earliest lineages all the way through to the mutual slaughter of the Rishnis and the and everything after. And really, I feel as though by summarizing it periodically for an imaginary reader who didn't know the epic, I actually was also summarizing it for myself. And I actually increased my own understanding of the overall arc of the epic and the overall kind of bone structure of the epic by doing that. And it made me realize that even though you can study these epics so much, you can read them over and over again, but there's always something more. There's always something more to be learned. And I find that fascinating about the epics, that they have an infinitude to them.
Yeah, and I really like this approach, Amit, that you said that, while summarizing it for the reader, you also sort of understood it better. It's sort of like this thing, that we do, in college or when we sort of study with friends, like in a group, right? Where you sort of summarize a lesson and teach it to somebody else, and then you realize, oh, this has sort of given me more insights into this lesson.
Right, they say that the best way to learn something, or rather, you've learned something when you can teach it to somebody else, right? So you
Yeah.
know that Shantanu knows the Ramayana because he's teaching
He
it,
can teach it,
to other people,
yeah.
right? Yeah.
Exactly, yeah. So, okay, great. So I'm really happy that, we've got a lot of insight into your process, into, your love for the epics. So this brings us to the second round of the interview, the second section, which is called the fun quiz, okay, where I'll be giving you three options and you have to pick one. Okay, no thinking allowed. So just whatever comes to your mind, okay? This is for Amit. All right, from all the titles in your book, pick one that you loved writing the most. Loved writing, basically the chapter, right? A, Perils of Marrying a River. B, From a Pail to the Palace. C, For the Love of a Blue Lotus.
I think that the first one for me, because that one, The Perils of Marrying a River, it deals with some of the earliest stuff of the Mahabharata, the earliest before Vyasa even. And that's when Shantanu he's marries the Ganga, right? And then he has this very, very harrowing experience of seeing her go and drown his kids one by one. And it's those very early elements of the epics that I have always found very fascinating. The Ramayana has, Kalidasa wrote something called Raghuvansha, which is the lineage, the Rama's forefathers, right? And that's also something that I find very, very fascinating. And the Ramayana, the Balkanda of the Ramayana, doesn't necessarily begin with that in Valmiki. But all that knowledge was there, and Kalidasa turned it into an epic. And in the same way, I find that those early lineages are very, very fascinating in Rama's case as well, because there's different ways in which his forefathers foreshadow his own epic story. He has an ancestor who dearly loved his wife and then lost his wife. He has a forefather who there it's a whole, I won't get into it, Dilip and
It's
Ajat and all
like
these
the
different people.
origin
But
story, as you said.
yeah, it's
That's
the
why you
origin
highlighted.
story, but it's so interesting to me how the entire epic is encapsulated, and the themes are sort of previously described in the early lineages. And so I've always loved the early lineages of each both of the epics. And I think that so it's the first chapter that you mentioned that I think I'd pick.
Oh, great. Okay, all right. For Shantanu, from all the life lessons in your book, which is your favorite or which is something that you stand by? A, rules are meant to be followed and flouting them can endanger your life. B, walk the talk. C, always target long-term goals rather than think about short-term emotions or benefits.
I think the third one, the target, the long-term goals, because normally we get shadowed and get paranoid or parochial by whatever we see if it's happening quickly, right? And this happens in Dashrath's case, the example that you're quoting, that Vishwamitra comes to take Ram and Lakshman and ask Dashrath that, can I take them to kill Taraka, Mari, Subahu, right? And Dashrath thinks that, and Dashrath says that, you can take me, you can take my Chaturangi Sena, which was Dashrath known for, right? And take my warriors. Why are you taking these 15, 16-year-old kids? That like Ram and Lakshman were not even 16 then, right? And then comes Vashishtha, the Kul Guru, which is the importance of Kul Guru in those kingdoms. And Vashishtha says two things to Dashrath. He says, my teaching with them is over. So Vashishtha was the first guru of all the four kids. My teaching with like a kind of a classroom training is over. Now they have to do, as in modern terms, we say on-job training, right? So they have to do practical training. And they are putting their arrows to a static target. Now they have to kill enemies, right? So they should graduate. And this time, Guru is coming to your door. Like, nothing better than this. Vishwamitra ji is an amazing guru. Why don't, and he's coming to the door, send him. And second thing he says, see, Vishwamitra ji, through his earlier warrior avatar and now with his spiritual avatar, is capable of shooing away those demons, right? He's asking for Ravana's Lakshman's help, meaning he's finding a good student in them, right? And but with a very heavy heart, right? Even then, the kids are kids. Like, it's 15, 16-year-old. They're going to the wilderness of a jungle. And then somehow he settles within himself that, okay, and I'm sending them. And Vashishtha Rishi puts this long-term view of the good of Ram and Lakshman that will happen in the process. The teacher that will they will get in the form of Vishwamitra, right? Because I'm a student of politics and I'm study politics, so I have to see what a politician is doing today or what he's saying today. Is he just saying for the heat of the moment, or he has layers to it, right? For a year, for a coming election, for a coming governance, or for the larger betterment of the country or the society. That's why I think that lesson, I keep reminding myself that, okay, keep thinking of the longer term target, though short term is very tempting most of the times. Yeah.
Yeah, and I think not just in politics, like it's something which was I found very relatable even for our everyday life. I think that's because we tend to sort of get distracted by short-term goals, as humans. Okay, now one favorite character from the Mahabharata for Amit. A, Kunti, B, Bhim, C, Duryodhan.
That's a very, very difficult one, and I want to make a disclaimer that I could pick any one of them and make a case for them. But I would have to say that as a writer, it's basically a split between Bhim and Duryodhan. But I think that if I had to pick one, it would probably be Bhim, because there's so much scope for comic relief when you're dealing with Bhim, because he's so big and he's so garrulous and he's so fun. And I felt that because the Book of Vows had so much heavy material in it, and there's so much serious stuff in it, it was nice to get Bhim in there and to have little comic relief through Bhim. So as a writer and writer creating something for readers, I liked having Bhim there, because it was very natural to give the reader a little bit of, a little bit of smiles in the course of a very, very bloody epic.
Definitely. I think he was one of my favorites as well. Okay. For Shantanu, one favorite character from the Ramayana. A. Ram, B. Sita, C. Kekayi.
Oh, very interesting. I thought you'll give my favorite option, Hanuman. But I can see Ram is obviously, but I should not say Ram, but that's an easy choice, because Ramayana is the journey of Rama, right? I think I should pick Sita. Why so? Because in the glory of Ram, right, a lot of these characters get lost, right? And I'll also at some point may come to Bharat and Shatrughan also. A lot of people in fun say, exactly what was Shatrughan doing in this whole story. But you'll realize Shatrughan was the one who's running the rule. I'll come back to Sita first because that's the question. See, when the exile was given to Rama, it was not given to Sita and Lakshman, right? Sita was the first one to volunteer for it, right? That, and these are the vows I took while doing the while our marriage, that in your happiness and in your sad days, right? And this is your tough time, I will be with you, right? That's the first instance. And the multiple instances during those 14 years, right? The character that she has shown, that she's also learning a lot of things with the gurus. So in those 13, 14 years, the whole three of them are hopping gurus, right? They're learning something from one guru, their family. And Sita is also learning a lot of life lessons and retelling through Valmiki ji, right? And then her character that was shown then when she was in exile or when she was in captivity, right? And the character she has shown. In fact, one instance when Ravana comes to her and says, give some month that I'm giving you maybe 2 months, and otherwise you have to marry, otherwise I'll eat you in my morning food, like a breakfast of today. And she's not even looking at Ravana. And like, can you imagine? Like, you are in the captivity of Ravana, you're surrounded by the demons and the soldiers of Ravana, and you're not even giving like bow to Ravana. You're saying, can I suggest you one thing? Why don't you go and apologize, Rama? Maybe he will pardon you, right? And that needs courage. That needs courage, right? In the captivity of someone mighty Ravana, right? And she's also very, very, very mindful that when she's getting kidnapped, she realized that I've done a mistake, right? She's dropped her jewelry at a particular place where she sees some set of people, so that when Rama comes tracing, he may end up finding those, and he really end up finding those with Sugriva and his team, right? And the last thing, when Hanuman shows up to find Mata Sita, she's not believing Hanuman blindly because she's already being fooled by Ravana once, and she's saying, how can I believe that you are sent by Rama? And then Hanuman ji has to produce the ring of Rama, which Rama already guessed that Sita may ask now. And then only, like a password, right? Like, show me a password that you can join in Zoom call, right? And she also returns her Chudamani, a hair clip, returned to Hanuman, returned Rama through Hanuman, so that Rama can believe that Hanuman has met the right Mata Sita, not some elusive version of Mata Sita. So she's this amazing character is doing all of this, right? But when you read the final reading of Ramayana, then you see the character of Mata Sita coming along, right? Which is like get missed in the larger glory of Rama. So yeah, Sita will be my friend.
Absolutely, yeah. I think that not just Sita, but all mostly women tend to sort of they're quite underrated in epics, stories, scriptures, all of that. So I'm glad to know she's your favorite. So now we come to the final round of the interview. Okay, this is the rapid fire round. So you can only answer in one word or one line. Okay, again, no thinking, but yeah, the briefest answers possible. Okay, where do you write? This is for both of you.
I write on a computer, my Mac. Yeah, I can write on pen and paper.
I write in my study on a Mac.
Awesome.
MacBook
okay
Air, technically.
okay one shloka from the Ramayana that you can swear by anytime. Chantan.
See, this is sad that still after reading Valmiki Ramayana, I've written translations. So my Sanskrit, I'm not not good in Sanskrit. Though I'm a student of Valmiki Ramayana, but I quote more of Tulsi Ramayana Chopai, which I already quoted, that Raghukul Reet Sada Chaliyai, Prana Jaye Par Vachana Jaye, that'll be my Chopai.
Okay, all right. One vow from the Mahabharata that you think applies even today, Amit.
Well, I think I don't know how many of those vows necessarily apply today because they were related to the throne of Hastinapur and the going after the Kauravas. So I think in general, the idea of the vow definitely applies today. And so, if you say it, do it. Or if you're not going to do it, don't say it.
Okay, all right. One spiritual destination that you want to visit for both of you.
See, in fact, I want to do the whole Ramayana circuit. And fortunately, I was there when Rama came back. And maybe I'm digressing. When I was in the Pran Pratishtha on 22nd January, I was able to relate a lot of things that Valmiki Ramayana said, that how people were happy when Rama came back, and similarly scenes I saw in the streets of Ayodhya when Rama really came back after the fight of 500 years, the legal battle. So yeah, now I want to go to the whole Ramayana circuit. I've been to a couple of places, but I make sure to there are multiple places. I can't go all of them in my lifetime, but I can go all the prominent places. So whole Ramayana circuit I want to cover.
Yeah, and I would like to go to the Himalayas. I've never been there, and I feel that I'm definitely kind of called there. And I would also like to go to Shirdi, which is the shrine of Sai Baba.
Oh, lovely. Okay, now if y'all could switch places, okay, Shantanu, what would you write about from the Mahabharata? Like just in one word or one line? And Amit, if you could write, about the Ramayana, what would it be?
So I think I still do some intersections of Ramayana and Mahabharata, right? And in my telling also I do some intersection, and that I want to write, right? So let's say in Ramayana we have the Suryavanshi kings, here we have the Chandravanshi, the lunar dynasty, right? And there is a connection between Hanumanji and Bhim, right? In the pataka, in the flag of Arjuna, there is a picture of Hanumanji, right? So I want to see the intersections of Ramayana and Mahabharata. Ramayana happened before Mahabharata. But in a lot of places, while giving the example, right, in Mahabharata time, they're giving the examples of Rama, the Ramayana characters and Rama himself, right? So I want to find those intersections between Ramayana and Mahabharata and write at some point about that.
Amit, yeah.
So it's funny you should mention that because in January, I published a book called The Later Adventures of Hanuman, which is for it's for younger readers, and it was 40 kind of original stories of what Hanuman experienced after Rama enters the Sarayu River, and he's alone. He's Chiranjeevi, so he goes on living forever. So he has adventures into the modern day, 40 of them. And that book came from Penguin India in January. In 2019, I wrote a retelling of the Ramayana in from every chapter from the voice of a different character. So I tell the whole story, but each chapter is it jumps among different stories. Even the squirrel on the bridge gets his story, and I progress the story by jumping among different characters, and so it all makes sense to the reader, but it's a sort of polyphonic, multi-voiced retelling of the Ramayana called Sitayana. That was 2019, also from Penguin Books, and then at Penguin India, and I've actually also written a Ramayana trilogy. And it's literally the same size as the Mahabharata trilogy. And so yeah, if you wait long enough, we have to wait for these to come out, and at some point that thing's going to come out too. So I'm already all over
Yes,
the
clearly. I especially love the one where you said that you progress the story through, different characters' POV, because I think that's something that I've also done in my novel, which is coming out later this year from
Oh
West
wow,
Nile.
congratulations.
Thank you.
Congratulations. What's
Thank
the
you.
title of it?
Oh, it's called You Envy the Kutinos and Other Migrants in the Middle East. Yeah. So it's
Wow.
really about a family, an Indian family who's living in the Gulf, and it's sort of, that milieu, because it's not really covered in a lot of
Yeah,
fiction.
did you live in the Gulf?
Yes. So I was born and raised there, which is why also, like I said, I don't have much context of the Hindu epics because of that.
I
So
see. Wow.
it's only when I came down here, sort of, like I think we came back in 2019, because as you don't get citizenship in the Gulf, unlike the
Right.
US or other places where you stay. So it's only after coming here that I've sort of, I've understood more about these epics, and of course through this interview as well. Yeah, okay, great.
Excellent. Congratulations. And
Thank you.
keep us in touch as it's
Yes,
released.
I'll definitely share it with you all, because and as you said, the multiple POVs is something that I'm very excited about. Okay, so this is the last question. Okay, what's next? Like literally, which book is coming out next, or which book are you working on next?
As I told you, I'm a political writer. I write on political topics, and 2024 election is coming, so I'm doing something on 10 years of Narendra Modi's work. On the Ramayana series, I'm still tied up between I'll write this is a Ramayana for families. I may write Ramayana for entrepreneurs or Ramayana for politicians. Which one I write first, I'll decide in due course along sitting with Penguin India. Yeah.
Nice. Amit, what about
So I wrote about the great Indian Civil War, right, which is the Mahabharata, and now I'm writing a big old novel about the American Civil War. So,
Ooh, exciting. I really, really
yeah.
love that both of you have really intense projects to work on, a lot of thinking, a lot of excitement. But I really loved, speaking to both of you. I think it gave me a lot more insight into the novels, and it's just the way you all narrated these stories, right? Just especially the difference between, both the Ramayanas, or what is sort of the preconceived notions we've all had about these epics, and sort of, how we can relate to it in our contemporary life. So thank you so much for sharing. I think I really enjoyed speaking to you about these books, and I'm really looking forward to the other books that you come up.
Thank you
Thank
for
you for
having
having us.
us, and your questions were wonderful. Thank you so much.
Yeah, and thank you for making me meet Amit Mazumdar, and I'll surely pick his books and start reading. Sounds fun.
Yes.
Hope you enjoy this episode of Books and Beyond with Bound.
This podcast is created by Bound, a company that helps you grow through story. Find us at Bound India on all social media platforms.
Tune in every Wednesday as we peek into the lives and minds of some brilliant authors from India and South Asia.